Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, the United States speaks out against the terror attacks in Pakistan. Egyptian plane incident. Hostage taking is making its rounds on the web. Reaction to Japan's new security measures. Miniatures are gaining popularity among baby boomers.
You can create a little world out of your imagination to be whatever you want it to be.
And we'll peek into the Library of Congress National Recording Registry. It's right here on The Voice of America. The United States has condemned in the strongest terms Easter Sunday's terrorist bombing at a park in Lahore, Pakistan, that left hundreds of people dead or wounded, including dozens of children. U.S. State Department spokesman John Kirby said it only deepens the shared resolve to defeat terrorism around the world.
And nothing's changed about our commitment to do what we can to help them deal with this threat. Because it isn't just, we saw terribly that it was certainly visited upon the Pakistani people this weekend, but as you and I have talked about before, it's not just a Pakistani threat, it's a regional threat, it's a global threat in many ways. So we stand by the people of Pakistan right now, and we also stand by our commitment to assist Pakistan going forward. This group in particular that claimed the Lahore attack is the TTP, which we know the Pakistani security forces continue to put under pressure. As groups like this get put under pressure, it is somewhat to be expected that they will look for ways to lash out, and suicide bombings and these kinds of dramatic terrorist attacks are ways to do that.
A White House spokesman called the attack grotesque and an outrage. A spokesman for the group Jamaat-ul-Ahrar, in faction of the Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan, or TTP, claimed responsibility for Sunday's attack aimed at Christians. Pakistani security forces have been on the move, launching raids and arresting suspects in at least three cities in Punjab province. Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif has vowed to avenge Sunday's attack. Terrorism analyst Greg Barton of Deakin University in Australia told VOA's Victor Beatty the government crackdown will not likely produce the kind of long-term changes needed in Pakistan.
Pakistan really needs to deal with the whole Pakistani Taliban situation. This group is a breakaway faction of the Taliban. They broke away in August 2014, but they reportedly rejoined 12 months ago. So they're still part of the overall loose network that is the Pakistan Taliban. There's reasons to suggest that the group broke away in August 2014 because of a sense of being inspired by what Islamic State was achieving. They were not joining Islamic State, but they wanted to shift the focus of Taliban militancy beyond the local issues of Pakistan to a more global stage. And even in their attack over the last few days, in their attack a month ago, both in conjunction with the assassination of the governor of Punjab, who tried to repeal blasphemy laws, there's a sense that they're being inspired by what Islamic State's achieving. And that's a worrying increase. To the west, in Africa, we see Al-Qaeda, the Red Peninsula, also doing the same thing, where its attacks, for example, in the Ivory Coast, suggest a sense of rivalry with Islamic State. And that points to a global dynamic we can't afford to ignore. If Pakistan doesn't really deal with the problem of the Pakistani Taliban, this thing is likely to get a lot worse before it gets better. And a short-term crackdown is not going to yield the results they need.
There are mixed results from these military crackdowns. Crime does go down, but these groups just seem to pop up elsewhere.
Yeah, and indeed, this group is primarily based along the Afghan border, just northwest of Peshawar. So it's not really operating in Punjab typically. In fact, it made a point of saying we can reach right over to the east, right over to this cosmopolitan city of the Punjabi elite in Lahore and launch an attack there. We can go anywhere. So you can crack down on them in Lahore, that's true, but they will retreat to their stronghold along the Afghanistan border. And frankly, so far, the Pakistani government and the Pakistani military has not proven able to deal with any of the Pakistani factions along that border, and it seems unlikely that even with renewed resolve that they're going to be able to really get to the root of the support base for this group.
In the capital, Islamabad, Islamic extremists protested for a second day Monday outside Parliament, demanding authorities impose Sharia law. Is there a concern about the precarious situation of the Sharif government?
Oh, certainly there has to be. These attacks, such as the manner of the one we saw in Lahore, in one sense could be read as symptomatic of a failing state, or at least a very weak state. There are real problems with the authority of the Pakistani government. It has the support of the majority of the people, as best we can tell from election results, but it doesn't have the capacity, at least hasn't so far, haven't proven the capacity to deal with what's essentially bullying and intimidation by a militant minority, whether in the form of street protests or more serious manifestations of political violence like terrorism.
And Greg Barton says another worrying aspect is that the Pakistani military now possesses tactical nuclear weapons, which are small, portable, and usually ready to use. He says it raises the chances of such weapons falling into the hands of terrorist groups. Well, an hours-long hostage-taking incident on an Egyptian plane has come to an end with the arrest of the hijacker. And this story has really been trending on the web. With details is social media reporter Andrew Palchevsky, and he joins me here at the Anchor Desk. Welcome, Andrew.
Thanks for having me, Sue. Well, indeed, this Egypt Air flight traveling from Alexandria to Cairo was hijacked by a man and diverted to Cyprus, allegedly over a dispute with his estranged wife or something to do with his estranged
wife. More of a love story than a terrorist attack.
It was. And so hashtag Egypt Air, just in the few hours after this incident, had already received over 200,000 uses on Twitter, this hashtag. So a lot of people talking about it, a lot of interest, of course, first starting out people saying could this be terrorism, kind of learning more about what's going on through social media. And then once we did find out that apparently it was this kind of odd love story or what have you, people kind of started making jokes and saying, okay, well, it's not terrorism. I think the internet kind of collectively breathed a sigh of relief that it wasn't something more dangerous. And then even as it was ending and they eventually arrested this man, we were seeing on social media, allegedly, some of the passengers taking selfies with him. Once they found out that it wasn't actually a terrorist hijacking, that the suicide vest he was supposedly wearing was fake, they were taking some pictures with him and posting them on Twitter.
I saw one of those pictures, and it was a happy, smiling tourist on the plane with this guy who didn't look very happy. And if it's real,
the other thing that we have to note is that initially, as this was going on, social media had a name that they were reporting that was incorrect as to who this hijacker was. So if this is an actual photo, and it may take some time to determine that as people sift through social media, it's kind of just a bizarre story for the social media age, that it kind of played out on social media. We're getting a look at this man for the first time, potentially, on social media. Just an interesting story in our social media age, how the news can kind of leap from wherever it's happening in the world to the internet.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Andrew.
Thank you.
It's interesting. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
A new study suggests that there is one facial expression we make that can communicate our negative feelings, disagreement, or express moral judgment with someone. This facial expression is understood in several languages and across a number of cultures. Writing in the journal Cognition, the researchers from Ohio State University and Purdue University call this negative facial expression the not face. Whether those conversing are native speakers of English, Spanish, Mandarin Chinese, and even American Sign Language, the not face can clearly get the message across without speaking a word. According to the study, the not face involves a furrowed brow, pressed or tightly closed lips, and a raised chin. The researchers also found that we tend to make this not face as frequently as we speak or sign the same words. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Japan's new security laws went into effect today, making it easier for the country to fight overseas and take part in international peacekeeping operations for the first time since World War II. Is the first reinterpretation of the post-war pacifist constitution's prohibition against collective security activities. The constitution's Article 9 prohibits the use of force to settle international disputes. It also comes amid a growing Asian threat environment from China and North Korea. The United States has welcomed the development, having updated their defense cooperation guidelines a year ago, but the Japanese public remains divided. A Kyoto News poll conducted on the weekend found nearly 50% of respondents opposed the laws, while 39% view them positively. Japanese Defense Minister Gen Nakatani said today the threat environment has changed, especially regarding terrorism. He said incidents that occur abroad are not necessarily unrelated to Japan's national security. He said, "We are living in times where it has become extremely difficult for one country alone to maintain peace." Michael Kusick is an adjunct professor at both Temple University and Waseda University, both in Tokyo. He explains the practical implications of the new laws.
Training between United States forces and Japanese self-defense forces will become much tighter and much easier to run. Up until now, there have been limits on what the Japanese side can do. There are always questions about whether a certain act or a certain form of training or a certain form of coordination transcend the anti-war Article 9 of the Constitution. That basically has been overridden by the legislation that comes into effect today, which allows for collective self-defense. It's still self-defense. It's still defending Japan, which is the primary goal of the self-defense forces. The name itself says that. But for the first time, Japanese forces can fight on behalf of others, on behalf of allies, on behalf of fellow participants in peacekeeping forces. That, until today, has always been extremely limited, if not outright banned.
We asked how the change in policy is being received in South Korea, China, and elsewhere in the region.
Mostly, they're quite muted. They knew that this was coming down the line, that there would eventually be a situation where Japan would come to some sort of decision. What they are carping on is the way the decision was made. In that, they are simply echoing the criticisms of the opposition here, which quite rightly point out that the method that the government used in order to effect this was contrary to the constitutional principles that Japanese governments have worked under for the last 60 years.
And Michael Kusick says Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's government, which pushed through the change nearly 2 years ago, underscores that the new security laws don't change Japan's post-war constitution. The laws simply end what he calls the asymmetric relationship where the U.S. handled its own defense and that of Japan. Now he says the relationship will become more balanced should the U.S. come under attack. Coming up on International Edition, miniatures, they're a big deal to collectors, and music being preserved for the ages. Miniatures are unique creations. The scale model replicas can be people, animals, furniture, buildings, or anything else that you can think of or imagine. Miniature dollhouses have mainly been known as a children's toy, but many adults also collect and craft them as a hobby. And the hobby is increasingly popular among baby boomers and seniors. VOA's June So has written this report, narrated by Carol Pearson.
This is a China teacup and saucer that has a cherry blossom motif. In the teacup, I recreated the Washington, D.C. tidal basin at cherry blossom time. There are photographers taking pictures. There's families walking along. And in the front is President Barack Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama.
Mary Paris started creating miniatures about 15 years ago when she retired.
A little world. You can create a little world out of your imagination to be whatever you want it to be. And I guess that's probably what interests me.
Paris is a member of the Mount Vernon Miniatures Club near Washington. She and others get together once a month in a library for individual or group projects.
This is a dollhouse that is occupied by a clown. What we're going to be doing is putting this together as a group and donating this to the convention.
The club's president, Laurie Sisson, says most of the members are over 50.
And there are people all over the world who have these interests. We meet online. I have friends in Turkey and in Australia. There are people in England that I send emails back and forth to. We're all friends. We all enjoy miniatures.
When Ruth Dubois bought this dollhouse 12 years ago, it was an empty shell.
And I've been working on it ever since. I put on all of the bricking. My husband put in the lighting for me, and I've been doing the wallpaper and the flooring, and I've been working on putting the contents of each room together.
Creating dollhouses that started as a hobby has grown to a full-time business for the Duboises after their retirement from government jobs. Their shop is in their house in Olney, Maryland. It's stocked with miniature furniture, accessories, and building materials, almost anything you can think of.
My husband does the building of houses. He puts in all of the electrical so that a house can have hanging lamps. I work with the customer to help pick out the kinds of flooring they want, the type of furniture that they want to put in. It's a lot of fun, and for me, working with the customers.
Dubois says her customers range from three-year-olds who come with their parents to people in their 80s.
We find a lot of people who are retired now have the time and the money to be able to do a dollhouse, something that they've always dreamed of.
I would say that a lot of the baby boomers grew up with hobbies, with some of these fiber hobbies. They don't have room for those anymore, but they've, again, have a challenge to make things smaller, and that they enjoy having a hobby that they can share with other people.
Sisson believes by creating and sharing the beauty of miniatures, they also share each other's lives. For producer June So, I'm Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
This is VOA.
This is Green Beat for a healthier planet.
A slow-moving loris missing all of its teeth, parrots with disabled wings, malnourished primates, wild animals who can no longer survive on their own, all share a 1.3-hectare home in Indonesia. Dharma Jaya Sukmana is with Indonesia's Animal Sanctuary Trust.
The sanctuary was founded to show our care for wild animals that, as we know, often live under threats including illegal wildlife trade, loss of habitat, and forest fires.
Despite strict international laws against wildlife trafficking, the nonprofit group Profauna says there was nearly a 70% increase in recorded cases of the illegal wildlife trade between 2014 and 2015. Sanctuaries like Bogor try to rehabilitate as many animals as possible to return to the wild, but some, like the loris, can never return. I'm Rebecca Ward for VOA's Green Beat.
The Library of Congress is, of course, known for its vast collections of books, available not only to members of Congress, but to everyone. Another one of the interesting resources offered is the National Recording Registry, which adds culturally significant audio to its vault every year. VOA's Jim Stevenson spoke about it with Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald.
Jim, this is one of the more fascinating little bits of musical culture that I really am interested in because it's just so eccentric. It's the National Recording Registry of the United States Library of Congress. Now, the Library of Congress, it is sort of like the nation's sound recording attic. I mean, they have over 3 million sound recordings. Mm. 450 of them, as of this year, have entered into the National Recording Registry. Now, the registry was established as part of the National Recording Preservation Act of 2000. And every year, it gathers 25 recordings that are of major cultural and historic importance to the United States. And some of this year's inductees include Piano Man, the 1973 debut hit single from Billy Joel.
I'm surprised they don't have that already.
Sing us a song, you're the piano man. Sing us a song tonight.
Master of Puppets by Metallica. This is their second album from 1986, and it's the first heavy metal album preserved by the Library of Congress. You have Gloria Gaynor's disco classic, I Will Survive.
I'll survive. I will survive.
You have A Love Supreme by jazz saxophonist John Coltrane. Now, the oldest recording this year is a 1911 recording of Let Me Call You Sweetheart by the Peerless Quartet. And the list also includes some spoken word recordings. We have George Marshall outlining his Marshall Plan for Europe in a speech from 1947. And we have fourth quarter coverage of Wilt Chamberlain's 100-point basketball game in 1962. And
in Hershey, Pennsylvania.
Wilt set a record that stands to this day with that game. These are just some of the incredible recordings that are now in the registry. And as I say, it runs the gamut, and you never know what is going to end up there. And if you want to see the entire list, you can go to my Twitter page, Ray on the Hits.
That's an excellent resource for anybody. It has the entire registry right there, plus much, much more from around the world.
I'm always adding. Right. It's so much bigger than all of us.
I bet if you tried to listen to this stuff end to end, you'd never get through it all in a lifetime.
Most likely. But every year they just add new and interesting recordings. I should mention also that they are now taking online suggestions for next year's registry. So if you have any particular favorites, you can just go online and suggest it. It's
okay, you can suggest this very interview if you like.
We can be immortalized. We can live forever.
Ray, it's always fun to have you come by and tell us about all of these wonderful and interesting places that our music ends up in besides our iPods.
Absolutely, you never know.
And as he mentioned, Ray on the Hits is your place to go on Twitter. Ray, thanks so much for stopping by.
Thank you, Jim.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE. Thanks for joining us today for International Edition.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. and Cambodian forces officially opened Angkor Sentinel 2016, an annual bilateral military exercise hosted by the Royal Cambodian Armed Forces and sponsored by the U.S. Army Pacific, during a ceremony March 14th at the Training School for Multinational Peacekeeping Forces in Kampong-Spu Province, Cambodia. This year marks the seventh iteration of the exercise designed to strengthen the two countries' humanitarian assistance and disaster relief capabilities and improve military-to-military cooperation. I believe the Angkor Sentinel exercise that begins today showcases some of the best kinds of things militaries accomplish for their nations and citizens, said Julie Chung, chargé d'affaires, U.S. Embassy, Phnom Penh. Angkor Sentinel's activities will include training and exchanges covering humanitarian assistance, disaster response, first aid, engineering, explosive ordnance disposal, countering improvised explosive devices, transporting people and supplies, and developing leaders. Any country, including both Cambodia and the United States, will be a better, safer place to live with military people who are skilled in these functions. The two-week exercise brings together Cambodian forces from the Royal Cambodian Army, National Center for Peacekeeping Forces, Mine and Explosive Remnants of War Clearance, and Gendarmerie Royale Khmer, with U.S. forces from the U.S. Army Pacific 8th Theater Sustainment Command, 130th Theater Engineer Brigade, 8th Military Police Brigade, 303rd EOD Battalion, the Idaho Army National Guard, 18th Medical Command, Asia-Pacific CIED Fusion Center, and 413th Contracting Brigade. Major General Edward Dorman III, the commander of the 8th Theater Sustainment Command, encouraged the more than 150 participants to enthusiastically embrace the opportunity to learn from each other's expertise and absorb each other's rich cultures and traditions. Humanitarian assistance and disaster relief are priorities for both of our countries, and as we cooperate together in this complex, ever-changing region, exercises like this one are critical to our regional stability and security, he said. When we join together, train together, and grow together now, we ensure that we are prepared together for whatever the future may bring. Angkor Sentinel's expert academic exchanges and training events culminated in a combined situational training exercise on March 25th. The U.S. is proud to partner with Cambodia to ensure stability and security for Cambodia and the region.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.